for inviting me today. The music was just so beautiful and so sweet and sets such a tone for your meeting together today. I'm so, this is something I haven't known anything about really, and as I've sat here and watched you come in, I've been struck with the sweetness of knowing at least one of the burdens you carry. When we go to church on Sunday and we file into those benches, we all know that everybody's carrying burdens. We know we've studied about the plan of salvation, and we know that that's part of the deal. But we don't know what burdens, and so sometimes we forget that everyone else has pockets inside them or are broken. And your willingness to let us all know at least one of those broken pieces in you, I think brings a spirit of humility and teachability and love that is pretty remarkable. I wish I could stay. I have to dive out of here because I have to be back in Salt Lake and for another meeting. And so I wasn't sad about not being able to stay until I sat here today and I looked at the program, and I would love to be here today and tomorrow, but I can't be. I want to begin. I'm going to do something that you'll think is a little odd, like, what is she talking about this for? But I promise you, I will get back to where I think it has relevance to you and to everybody else. I promise you, just stick with me. I want to begin by reading a piece of poetry, and we don't often do that, so you'll just have to stay awake. If you're just panicked about poetry, relax. This is called The Sun, and it's by Mary Oliver, who, frankly, is one of my favorite poetesses. Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful than the way the sun, every evening, relaxed and easy, floats toward the horizon and into the clouds or the hills or the rumpled sea and is gone? And how it slides again out of the blackness every morning on the other side of the world, like a red flower streaming upward on its heavenly oils, say on a morning in early summer at its perfect imperial distance. And have you ever felt for anything such wild love? Do you think there is anywhere in any language a word billowing enough for the pleasure that fills you, as the sun reaches out, as it warms you, as you stand there, empty-handed? Or have you, too, turned from this world? Or have you, too, gone crazy for power or things? I love that picture of that sort of moment where the sun rises and where the sun sets at night, and where you just sit there in wonder without the ability to describe it. Photographers call that the magic hour because the light is so uniquely different. That hour after the sun rises, after it peaks over, and the hour before it disappears. And there's a warmth to the color. Sometimes they call it a golden hour, but it's when they want to do photography, because something magic happens, the magic hour in that time. There are so many models of transition in the natural world. Transition for every single day from dark night to daylight, from daylight to darkness. Transition. There's the chrysalis, where the caterpillar is in this transitory state for some time. It's a quiet state before it emerges into a beautiful butterfly. There's spring. Is there anything, I don't know about the rest of you from other places in the country, but spring in Utah is fabulous. No matter what kind of a winter we've had, it's been winter. And when spring comes, you just go, oh, it's really going to happen. We really are going to have warm and blue skies again and warm sun. And it always comes to me as just a little bit of a gift, a surprise. And we don't know how long spring's going to be in Utah. It'll be freezing cold one day, and the next day we can smell something different. And one day there won't be blossoms, and the next day there will be a tree full of blossoms. And so it's a transitory, it's a transition season in a way. It's not a season that we plan to do a whole lot in. We plan for summer. We get ready for summer. But that spring is in between winter and summer, and it's the same thing with fall. There's a different kind of thing to spring and fall. They're transition seasons. When she read my introduction, she said that I was a full-time missionary for public affairs. I'm actually not. I was released in March. And so this is a time of transition for me, and that's basically why I've been sort of interested in exploring this topic. And it's taken me back to the transitions that I've done all of my life. You know, we've all done millions of I don't know how many transitions we've done, but it's the transition from unmarried to married. It's the transition to having no children to that first baby. It's the transition when a spouse dies and you adapt to a new kind of a world as a single person. So we've all done a million kinds of those transitions, and I've, for whatever reason, I've been very thoughtful about this transition from a full-time mission to I don't know what. And that's part of what it is. I can't tell you how many people have asked me as March approached, are you going to re-up? What are you going to do if you don't re-up? And during this, and part of the reason for that is that it was an odd mission where I stayed in my own home. I slept in my own bed. I did my own yard work. And then I went to work every day from 9 to 5. And I was the only full-time missionary in the public affairs department. So it was hard for me to remember that I was on a mission. It felt sometimes like work. But one of the things I had done was I had just said to myself, this is consecrated time. I have to pretend I'm in Buenos Aires. And so I unhooked myself from all sorts of speaking things, all the committees I was on, all boards, all those kinds of things, neighborhood responsibilities, ward responsibilities. And I just did the minimum things with my family, and I just said, this is consecrated time. Because of that, when I saw the release coming, I thought, I have to make some decisions here about what the next phase will be. And the first decision I made was that I wouldn't make any decisions. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about transition times, honoring times when you aren't making decisions, honoring times when things are working inside you and giving that space a kind of reverence and letting it do its thing, do its work, letting God do his work without being frantically busy. I think back when my husband died, and I know that this is a unique kind of loss, and it's more pervasive than the loss of a full-time mission or even the loss of employment and the loss of health, although in some cases that's what losing your spouse entitled was dealing with, huge and ongoing losses of health. Since my husband died about 6.5 years ago, I've learned some very surprising things. Just like all of you, I can almost list them. I've learned how my marriage worked. It's not something I'd ever paid much attention to before. I know what pieces were his and what pieces were mine and how we created that kind of synergy, and I was totally unaware of that. I learned how much of him had actually become me. Someone said to me at the time of his death, oh, you're so fortunate because you've always had a separate life from Jim. You've always done your own thing, and you can kind of go back and do that. And I said, hang on just a minute. I said, part of every cell of my body is him. I don't have separate places of my life. And whenever I'm in some other area, part of part of every part of me is part of him. He's become part of me. There's no way I can leave that loss behind and go back to some kind of life that didn't include him, because there is no part of that life. And I learned how true that was. I learned how our family works. I learned how the dynamics of the children and parents and all that kind of thing works. I learned more about my faith. I had an opportunity to prove to myself and to the Lord that I really believe. And I'm not sure I really had that opportunity before. I learned more about that feeling of being cared for and loved from the other side that I think has always been part of my life because of my faith in God. But it was so clear. That feeling of being protected and watched over and cared about from the other side of the veil. There are so many things, important things I learned. But perhaps the most surprising and important thing I learned was that everyone's walk through loss is different. I feel much less able to say, oh, I know what you mean, because I don't know what they mean. Everyone's loss is different. It's colored by so many things. And particularly when it's a loss of an intimate partner, it is colored by so many dynamics that are so subtle that I can't possibly know what your loss means. And so when people say, oh, you're lucky, because you must know just what to say. What should you say? And I think, I know less what to say. I know less what to say. But I do know more about the sacredness of each of us owning our own loss and not expecting it to look like anyone else's. I think it's safe to say that regardless, the loss of a spouse turns your life upside down. And because of that, I think it requires for everybody significant transition time. It's like that sun rising in the morning. It's like going from darkness to daylight. And somewhere in between there is a whole lot that needs to be taken care of. And that's why I've chosen to talk about the sacredness of transition time, that time in between. One of the recurrent questions I was asked when my husband died was, are you going to sell your house? Are you going to move? So you're laughing about that. And I just looked at him and I thought, are you kidding me? Am I going to, what? You know, what do you mean? And I've looked at that and I never did figure out an answer to that. And people are still asking me that, and it's 6.5 years later and I still don't have an answer for that. But I have come to believe that they want me to have a plan. You know, they really want me to have a plan, because if I have a plan, then they cannot worry about me. And they love me. So why would they not want me to say, yes, I'm going to sell the house, I'm going to move here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that? Because then they can say, oh, she's okay. Well, you can't do that. And the reason we can't do that is that we're spending a lot of energy, and I know some people do it, but we're spending a lot of energy simply dealing with what we have to deal with. It's physical energy, it's mental energy, it's emotional energy, it's spiritual energy. Elder President Uchtdorf said, it is good advice to slow down a little, steady the course, and focus on the essentials when experiencing adverse conditions. I love that. We don't often get permission in this church, this little busy church, to slow down, steady the course, and focus on the essentials. To me, that just means 3 meals a day and keeping the kids alive. You know, focus on the essentials. And it's obvious the reason we do that. We see it with the body, that if you just give the body enough rest and comfort, it has remarkable self-healing capacities. Well, so does the spirit. If we give it enough rest and enough comfort, it heals itself, our spirits, aided, of course, by our Father in heaven. But we have to allow it. It's just like saying somebody with pneumonia, they ought to get up and start running the track, get those lungs working. No. The best thing for a person with pneumonia is just rest, is just doing nothing for a while. And then the body has some self-healing capacities that even before the days of antibiotics, people sometimes got well from pneumonia simply because they gave the body a chance to heal itself. So I think one of the things we have to do in our world of people wanting us to be busily engaged in good causes at every moment is to say, no, I'm going to wait this one out. I'm going to wait for a minute. Does that mean we just don't get out of bed in the morning and we just eat chocolates and, you know? Of course. Yeah, she wants that to be true. Well, you don't quote me as saying that, as saying giving you permission to do that. But, you know, if you need to do it, you need to do it. My husband died of ALS, and he was diagnosed with ALS after we had a mission call just 2 weeks before we were to go into the MTC, and so we had unhooked ourselves from all of our lives. We didn't have any obligations at all, and we were getting ready to go on this mission when he was a physician, and he'd had these symptoms and had been worried about it for a long time, but they kept saying, oh, no, it's this, and he just said, I've got to look at this because I'm worried about ALS. And when they did, they were able to diagnose it was ALS. And so suddenly we had to tell everybody, for one thing. We didn't have a chance. We didn't have that transition time to let ourselves wrap ourselves around what was happening. It was the next hour. We're out on the streets, and people are saying, oh, we're so excited about your mission. And we have to say, it's not happening, and this is what is happening. And so we didn't have that transition time, and I'll tell you, that was painful. We didn't have any time to kind of digest that news, and some of you will know that if you don't have time to digest something, and it just happens that you feel the need to do that. But his ALS progressed rapidly enough. I mean, it didn't feel rapid at the time, but now I look back on it, it was. That every time he'd go to do something that he hadn't done for a couple of weeks, he couldn't do it. So that there was just this continual loss that was in front of us. And he wasn't in so much pain, and he would wake up. He said, it's getting hard for me to get out of bed in the morning because I wonder what today I'm going to figure out that I can't do anymore. And so he said, it's getting hard for me to face the day because I feel okay when I'm lying in bed. And we talked about that a lot. And one day after, and the first 2 months were like somebody punched us in the gut. And then one day we were just trying to fill ourselves constantly with Book of Mormon reading together and Ensigns, and we reread President Irene's talk about making note in a journal of how the Lord touched your life that day, how the Lord was working in your life that day. And so we began to do that. And every night we would spend a minute writing down what had happened during that day that was his work in our lives. And honestly, it was like we flipped a switch. And what we were in reality doing, and what I said I will never again do, we quit living in the future. And we quit living in the past. And we lived in the present. Because at the end of every day, we had had such tender mercies and wonderful things happen that were small but had been unnoted in the past, that were so clearly from God, that we said, why would we not be okay with another day? Why would we not be okay with another day? And so that idea of living in the present instead of the future or the past was just burned into my soul. And I have to remind myself of that every once in a while. And so when people say to me, what are you going to do after this mission? I think, you know what? Today was a great day. And I don't know what tomorrow will be, but there will be good things because God has never not provided great days. And there will be plans that will just arise, and there will be obligations that I will feel right about taking on. But I don't need to fret. I don't need to give myself or anyone else an outline for the future. I don't want to preach irresponsibility here. Like, don't spend all your life insurance or whatever, you know, thinking you're going to just live in the present. Don't spend everything you have today. But I am going to say that I think we get crazy in our world about living in the future instead of the present. And there is so much joy. I know a woman in terms of that difficult transition time right after her husband died. She told me that she bought some notebooks. You're not going to believe this. Maybe some of you have done it. She bought some notebooks, and she started at First Nephi, and she copied by hand the entire Book of Mormon. Yeah, you haven't done it, have you? I didn't know what to say. I didn't know whether to say that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard or that's the most amazing thing I've ever heard. And she was telling me about it, and another woman came up and heard us talking, and she said, this is you'll think this is odd because I did this too. And I said, you're kidding me. And she said, I can't tell you what it was like to just do kind of a mindless task. Just a mindless task. I had something to do day after day for an hour or two that just was meditation time without a focus. She wasn't preparing for a lesson, and she was busy with a hand. And I said, I'm so embarrassed because I do jigsaw puzzles. Book of Mormon, jigsaw puzzles. I'm just saying, really? But that's the reason I do just jigsaw puzzles, is that every once in a while when I think, oh, I'm just so lonely and I'm hurting and I need my head to rest. I just need to put my head to rest for a little while, to slow down. I need to slow myself down, and I can't just sit. I have trouble doing that, and I don't want to I just want to do something mindless. I'll get out a jigsaw puzzle. And I think, how many of you have done that? Yeah, okay, I'm not weird. It's the woman with the Book of Mormon. I just wanted to make sure what was weird. But I get that. I'm not a farmer, but I like the word fallow. I like the idea that wise farmers know that soil needs to rest and regroup, that every few years you don't plant the same crop, you don't plant any crop, you let it lie fallow to replenish it. It speaks to the importance of replenishing time between seasons of productivity. I like that. So transition times in our lives, including mourning, the death of a spouse, or other big transitions, can be replenishing times. I served with Sister Jeanette Beckham in the Young Women General Presidency, and when she would talk about adolescence, she'd say, you don't realize there's a sense of loss going on all the time for adolescents because they're in such a period of change. And she said, change always feels like loss at first. I like that. Because you're losing something, but you don't know what you're going to be getting. So change always feels like loss at first, and change is good. Change is what we're about. Change is personal growth. Change is constant in our world. So to be able to honor that sense of loss that goes with change, I think is really important. Sister Beckham, when we were first called into the General Young Women Presidency, this is one of the smartest, wisest women I've ever known. And she said, you go to work, they set you apart in conference, they present your name in conference, you go the next day, they set you apart, and you go to your office and you start to work. And there are letters coming in and there are decisions to be made. And Jeanette said, whoa, I'm not going to answer that letter yet. I'm not going to do that yet. She said, we need time for this to settle in. She said, this is sacred time. This is like having a new baby. It's kind of, everything's upside down for a while, and it settles down, and you can't rush it, and you can't impose order on it. You just honor it. You honor this time of whatever you want to call it, learning, beginning, chaos, transition, whatever you do. You honor it, and you don't rush into it thinking, I've got to figure it all out and do it right now, or I've got to do something before I even begin to figure anything out. I like the phrase long-suffering in the New Testament and in the Doctrine and Covenants. And I have my own little private definition of long-suffering. This isn't church approved either. But you know how the Savior said, suffer the little children to come unto me? In that sense, suffer means allow. Allow the little children to come unto me. I think long-suffering means that we'll allow time to work its wonders. We live in a world, honestly, where if the first quarter earnings are down, you scrap the CEO. You know, we just want results and we want them fast, and we aren't long-suffering. I think it is a godly virtue. I think he is long-suffering because he allows us time. He allows a long time for us to grow and to change, to learn, and to become like him ultimately. And so I think one of our great privileges in mortal life is to learn that skill, to learn how to allow time, to think more, think less about the future and more about savoring the present. What is this obsession we have with busyness? I don't know whether it was our Puritan forefathers or whether it was Brigham Young and his little busy bees and beehives and everything else, but there's sort of this cultural thing we have of checking on everyone to make sure they're busy and that we're re-upping busy enough. A few weeks ago when I was thinking about this very thing and I was holding my own against people that I felt were pushing me into things. Could you do this? Could you do this now? Now that you're not on a mission, could you, you know? And I felt like I was being pushed into that. I sat down next to a friend who's a widow, and I said, how are you doing? She said, oh, I'm so busy. I'm just so busy, busy, busy. And she's, this is exactly the way she said it. Last night, or this morning, I was up till 2 o'clock in the morning, and I still didn't get everything done. I have so much to do. And because I was thinking about these concepts, I thought, put a star on your forehead. You are such a prize pupil. You are so, isn't that nice? I didn't say that. I didn't say that. I didn't say that. But I was thinking about that, and I thought, what she's, this is my kinder self saying this, after I got through with the star. I thought, she wants me to know she's okay. I haven't seen her for a while. We're both widows. And when I say, how are you doing? I'm wanting to know she's okay, and she's wanting to tell me she's okay. And the best way she can tell me that in our funny little beehive culture is to say, I'm so busy, busy, busy. I don't even get to sleep at night, you know. 2 o'clock this morning, I still don't have it all done, you know. But I think she's trying to reassure me and maybe herself that she's okay. We don't have to do that. We don't have to do that. Someone asks us, okay, we can say, yeah, I've got more to do than I can do, but I feel good. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling like I'm going in the right direction, or I'm feeling like life's good. How about you? You know, this whole one-up of who's the busiest, who's the tiredest, who's the most overwhelmed, who's the, you know, whose list is the longest. We get into it, we Mormons, don't we? Yeah, yeah. And it's not that we aren't busily engaged and that we don't want to be engaged in good work. But is being engaged in good work the same thing as having every minute programmed? Is it the same? I don't think it is. I love what C.S. Lewis describes. He describes the new creature, somebody who has been born of God, as in the new creature that Paul describes in the New Testament. And I love the way he does it. He calls them new men, and he said, they're dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I have admitted, are hardly recognizable, but others can be recognized. Every now and then, one meets them. Their very voices and faces are different than ours. They are stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable, but you must know what to look for because they do not draw attention to themselves or what they do. You tend to think that you're being kind to them when they are really being kind to you. They love you more than other men do, but they need you less. We must get over, and then this is parenthetical for us girls, we must get over wanting to be needed in some goodish people, especially women. That is the hardest of all temptations to resist. This fetish to be needed, to be at the middle of and critical to everyone else's. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You will wonder where it comes from. And when you have recognized one of them, you will recognize the next one more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how should I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly across every barrier of color, sex, class, age, and even of creeds. In that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. To put it at the very lowest, it must be great fun. So he's talking about this desire to be holy and this desire to be like God. And is it about letting everyone know how much we do or how critical we are or feeling so vital and needed in everyone's life? I'll tell you two conversations I've had. One of them I was really good at it and one I was really bad at it. I'll tell you the really bad one first. One of my daughters who lives in Pennsylvania, when we start talking about what am I going to do when the mission's over, and I said to her, you know, I am really being, I'm going to really be deliberate about some things, and I'm really going to keep enough spaces in my life that I can just come back, I can just fly back to see you, to help you whenever you need help. And I said, and I can be helpful to the other girls whenever they need help. I've got five daughters. That's a lot of daughters and a lot of grandchildren, and I feel like I haven't been as available to them, particularly during the last year. And so I said, I want to be free enough that I can come back and help you. They call me FEMA. Because in a minute, if there's an accident or if there's a disaster, I cancel everything and I go. But it's FEMA. It's not just, and so I said, I just want to be more available to be helpful. And she looked at me and she said, how about if you just enjoyed us? Yeah. That's something, isn't it? I wanted to be more helpful. And she said, how about if you just enjoyed us? Just took the time to enjoy us. Would that be okay for me to put on my calendar for the next little while, enjoying my children, enjoying my grandchildren? Or would that not seem productive enough? Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you about a good conversation I had, and this is true. I am a hero in this, but it's true. Not too long before my mother died, and she never complained about being old. In fact, I would press her. I'd say, don't you hate being old? And she'd say, it is what it is. But one day she did say to me, I'm just no good to anyone. I'm just not useful. And in one second, I said, oh, Mother, you are so useful. I said, every time you come in a room, it gets better for everybody. And I mean that. I think it's what my girls were trying to say about me. Mother didn't see it in her, but she had a light that was really useful. She wasn't bailing anybody out, and she wasn't doing dishes, and she wasn't fixing food, and so she thought she wasn't useful. But she was useful. I don't see that I'm any light to my kids, so I feel like I've got to bail them out. I've got to be FEMA in order to do what I need to do for them. Maybe I've got some light and some love that is useful to them. And maybe every one of us do. Maybe our just showing up is useful. That you can't take on a big church calling right now, or you have demands on your time, or whatever. Your showing up with your light may be useful. It may be just the thing that people need. It may not be about how much time you spend in the kitchen and how you can't help with funerals anymore because you're working or because, you know, it may not be about that at all. And you may be much more useful than you know. I want to read some advice that President Hinckley gave to BYU students, if I can find it. This is really strange. I know I brought it. Okay. And I think it's important to realize that he was doing it to BYU students. He wasn't doing it at a Widows and Widowers conference, and he wasn't doing it to old people who are retiring. He was doing it to young people, and when you hear it, I think it's for everybody. He said, you need time to meditate and ponder, to think, to wonder at the great plan of happiness that the Lord has outlined for his children. You need to read the scriptures. You need to read good literature. You need to partake of the great culture which is available to all of us. You know, this is kind of permission to sit down and listen to a beautiful symphony, isn't it? And you don't even have to be folding laundry when you're doing it. Okay? I have trouble with that. He said, I heard President McKay say to the members of the 12 on one occasion, brethren, we do not spend enough time meditating. President McKay was talking to the members of the 12. There are no busiers than they are in terms of what they're trying to do every day. And he's saying you need to meditate. I believe, and then President Hinckley goes on, I believe that with all my heart. Our lives become extremely busy. We run from one thing to another. We wear ourselves out in thoughtless pursuit of goals which are highly ephemeral. We are entitled, okay? We are entitled. I'd like you to hear that word again. Entitled to spend some time with ourselves in introspection and development. He said, I remember my dear father when he was about the age I am now. President Hinckley was 89 at the time. I looked that up. He lived in a home where there was a rock wall in the grounds. It was a low wall, and when the weather was warm, he would go and sit on his wall. It seemed to me he sat there for hours thinking, meditating, pondering things that he would say and write, for he was a very gifted speaker and writer. He read much, even into his very old age, and he never ceased growing. Life was for him a great adventure in thinking. And then he says to the students, your needs and your tastes along these lines will vary with your age, but all of us need some of it. So it isn't, what I'm trying to say is that it isn't just the transition times. It isn't just after the death of a spouse or during it, when you're getting used to a difficult illness or whatever. That it's all of us need some of it all of the time. All of us need some of it all of the time. Slowing down allows us to be more deliberate, more intentional, more purposeful. I think one of the reasons, and I remember my grandfather sitting on that little rock wall in the sun, there's something about being outdoors that is critical to our spirits. I believe that. And there's no end of studies coming out that talk about that, the loss of that in children's lives and the loss of that in all of our lives. I have a therapist friend who told me that when she's dealing with clients who are anxious and stressed beyond their ability to cope, she says to them, when you feel that coming up on you, walk outside and touch a piece of nature. This isn't nature. Oh, it is. No, it isn't. This doesn't do it. This does not do it. You've got to walk outside. You can't do it here. But if we just go out and touch a piece of nature, it makes a difference. My friend, who's Japanese, told me about the Hanami, which is a cherry blossom festival in Japan. And she said in this highly wired, highly competitive culture, she said Hanami is the time when the cherry blossoms come out. And she said everybody goes out and Japanese are so tidy. They go out and they spread little blue, like tarp-like blankets on the ground, and they sit and they watch the cherry blossoms fall. Yeah, you felt that, didn't you? And she told me about the first time she saw that. She went back to visit her relatives, and she said all of these little squares of blue tarps and black heads, she was up on a hill, and then she said we could see the blossoms falling, and they sat all day long. Do you love that picture? Go out and sit in your yard or the park or somewhere and just sit there for a minute and breathe, or for more than a minute, for an afternoon. I'd like to read you a story that I pulled out of the Ann Siner era years ago, and I did not get the name of the woman who wrote it. She was a 22-year-old. She had been widowed as a 22-year-old mother of two. And she was finding that the mornings, when most husbands leave for work, and the evenings, when they usually return home, were her most difficult times. She stumbled onto a way to mitigate the sadness. In her words, "Instead of struggling to fight off sadness and loneliness in the house each morning, I decided to step outside to greet Heavenly Father in the sunrise, partaking of the beauty only He, the source of light, could offer. The mellow hues of refracted sunlight witnessed of His love, and deep swelling gratitude began to fill my aching soul, sweeping away the darkness and securing a wholesome perspective for the day." It's the magic hour, isn't it? At sunset, she returned to the porch, witnessing that, quote, "He begins and ends each day in beauty, silently setting forth breathtaking loveliness uniquely crafted for that day and beckoning us to be happy in Him." She concludes her story looking back over 40 years of sunrises and sunsets. What could have been a long and lowly widowhood has instead been richly blessed by harvesting the sunrises and sunsets He has given every day. I love this hymn to the magic hours. It seems to me such a remarkable thing to have stumbled upon. I'm with Eliza Arsenault. I'm a big Eliza Arsenault fan, and she was big on being useful. And she was big mostly on being useful to the kingdom. But maybe there are lots of ways to be useful. I don't want to do that. I'm going to skip a couple of things. Just stay with me. We all have days or even years when there's too much to do. And I am the first to say that widowerhood are not times of ease. I was just telling a girl down here today, after I was widowed, there was a man in my ward who sat down the next day and he said, "What are you doing over there without Jim?" And I said, blah, 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 blah. I don't know what I said. Blah, 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 blah. And then a couple of months later, he said it again to me. And he said, "What are you doing? What are you doing over there?" And then I was ready for him. I said, "I'm trying to do a lot of the things I've always done, and I'm trying to do everything he did." He said, "Oh," and he didn't ask me again. So it isn't about being busy. There's plenty to do when you're left with playing both parts. It isn't about having empty time. And so we have to, perhaps when you get through that initial phase when you can't think and you really can't do very well, maybe we have to be pretty purposeful and deliberate about giving ourselves some quiet time. Huge slow movements in the world today slow eating. Have you heard of the slow eating movement? You can look it up. You can Google it. Slow reading groups where you go to the library and everybody reads slowly. But, you know, there's a backlash against our American busyness. And all of us in this culture can be a little deliberate about it. I don't know what it is you do, but think for a minute. What is it that I do? Is there a time after I put the kids to bed, or is there a time after my family's left where instead of bustling around, or is there a time just before bed every night, before I say my prayers, when I put out the light, that I can just sit, I can just sit and think a little bit? Maybe it's every fast day. I kind of like that. I keep a notebook in my purse of just notes during the month or whatever, or scriptures I've read or something. And sometimes on fast day, I'll just sit for a while, and then I'll get out that notebook and just kind of read slowly through them. And it just seems to put me where the Lord wants me to be. It may seem simplistic or silly. I believe, my firm belief is that the greatest privilege we can claim is the privilege of personal revelation. We have been given that privilege. And I can't think of a better one to have been given, and that we live beneath it. I believe that personal revelation is richest in the life that includes places and spaces for quiet revelation, reflection, for meditation, for time to think of the endless, to get rid of the endless tasks of endless days. Let me repeat what President Hinckley said to the BYU students. Your needs and your tastes along these lines will vary with your age, but all of us need some of it. Elder Ballard has cautioned us over and over again, be still and know that I am God. The Holy Ghost is the instrument through which God lets us know that we are His, that we are loved, that we have a mission to fulfill. And every one of us in this room are still alive. Don't you think that's interesting? There isn't one dead person here. None of them showed up. So that means there is reason. There is a reason for us to be here. We're not just waiting to go to the other side. There's a reason for us to be alive. Every one of us has things to do, but most of all, we have things to become. We each have the privilege of being guided to complete our individual missions, and we can do it more deliberately and more intentionally if we stop doing every once in a while and sit on a wall or watch the sunrise or read an exquisite piece of literature, or listen. Just listen to music, or listen to the birds. Can this not give God a place where He can replenish us, where He can work in us, that we can do according to His will and be filled with the wonder and dignity of what it means to be His sons and daughters? That is my prayer in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.